Welcome to the VA HSR&D Investigator Insights podcast series. In this episode, Query Dissemination Coordinator Diane Hanks speaks with Anne Elizabeth Montgomery, affiliate investigator in Birmingham, Alabama, and John Blasnich of the Center for Health Equity Research and Promotion about their recent work on assessing the risk for housing instability among transgender veterans.
Can we first talk about the difference between homelessness and housing instability?
I like to frame it as housing instability, this experience. Mm-hmm. It includes homelessness and risk of homelessness because it's not, homelessness is, it's a continuum, or housing instability is a continuum. So homelessness is sort of like the very bad end of this continuum, and sort of risk of homelessness or is at the sort of, I guess, better end, or, you know, stably housed is at the best end. And so it's such a fluid state for so many people. Most people who become homeless are homeless for one day.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who live in a state of at risk of homelessness for a very long time and never become homeless. Mm-hmm. So we kind of use that like as a umbrella term. Mm-hmm. And then for this particular study, the way that we assessed housing instability is veterans' responses to two questions. And the first asks, for the past 60 days, have you been in housing that's stable and safe?
Mm-hmm.
And then the second is, are you concerned that you won't have housing that's stable and safe for the next 60 days? So in this, especially in this particular, for this particular study, we could say homeless, but that may not be accurate. Mm-hmm. But we know if someone says, yeah, I've been concerned about my housing in the past 60 days, or I'm concerned about my housing coming up, you know there's some level of housing instability happening. You know, all veterans who come to VA outpatient care are asked these two questions about their housing. And so we interviewed 60 veterans who screened positive, so who said they had recently experienced housing instability or were concerned that they would in the near future. Mm-hmm. And we're like, what do these questions mean to you? And from that, we got sort of how veterans understand, veterans who said that they're experiencing unstable housing, how they kind of understand what stable housing is.
Mm-hmm.
And it came down to it being affordable, it being structurally and functionally adequate. So no pests, having a bathroom, those kinds of things. Knowing that it's permanent. So it was much more than just, you know, being housed and not being housed was much more than just being under a roof.
The focus on the transgender community and veterans, veterans who are transgender, how did that come about with this particular study and why?
So Anne Elizabeth and I were connected through a mutual friend at the Center for Health Equity Research and Promotion in Philadelphia. And I think it was at a VA meeting maybe that we had sort of, we first met in person and then sort of followed up over email about this idea of Anne Elizabeth had this massive cohort that she developed through her IIR funding. And then I had my current CDA that was focused on transgender veterans, and a part of my CDA was looking at and trying to identify social determinant issues among transgender veterans. So we got to talking about how we could blend our research programs together, and this was a really productive, fortuitous meeting.
So tell us a little bit about the study and your findings, and I also at some point want to know about the transgender veterans and how they feel about being part of research, and how accessible they are, and how vulnerable they feel, or don't.
This study is really sort of a couple of studies. So we had a qualitative study specifically about HUDVASH, which is permanent supportive housing, but the quantitative piece was, you know, I had this access to this data set of 6 million veterans who responded to this screen for housing instability. It's known that transgender people are at higher risk of homelessness or housing instability, and this gave us a really unique opportunity to look at that relationship with a huge sample size and with lots of data, because you know, a lot of other studies are, they may be just survey samples or really small samples of people, but you know, this, we have like medical record data for many years. We have multiple indicators of housing instability that we can look at. So we basically just using the existing 6 million veteran cohort, identify the about 6,000 veterans in that cohort who, you know, are they at increased odds of self-reporting housing instability? Mm-hmm. Are they, you know, what is their use of VHA homeless programs? Mm-hmm. And we found that they are more than double the odds of screening positive for housing instability, transgender veterans do. But they also are more likely to use VHA homeless programs. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is we looked at maybe 7 different types of homeless programs. Mm-hmm. And transgender veterans are much more likely to use HUD-VASH, which that's where veterans get a housing choice voucher from the public mm-hmm. housing authority and go and find their own apartments. Or supportive services for veteran families, which is sort of supportive services, case management, and temporary financial assistance to, again, get your own independent apartment, as opposed to living in sort of an emergency, congregate, single-sex setting, which can be a real barrier for that population.
Right.
Yeah, and I think the part about the services use was really the, I think the unique new aspect mm-hmm. we could lend to this. I think finding out that transgender veterans are at a higher risk for homelessness or higher, you know, prevalence of homelessness among them is something that aligns with what we know from the literature, and we can show that it's actually happening among the veteran population too. I think that's important from an epidemiology mm-hmm. standpoint, but the services use part is something that mm-hmm. I think has been relatively unexplored in literature just because people don't often have those data.
Yeah.
Service organizations themselves don't often collect these data, or there's just so few people in them that we can begin to understand patterns in them. Mm-hmm. So with having this massive data set and so many different services the VA has created over the years to mm-hmm. for the goal of ending homelessness among veterans, that we were able to look at such a broad array is, I think, a big step forward for this research. We don't collect sex and gender mm-hmm. In our medical record or administrative data in a way that people can reflect their current gender identity. The measure that we use, or what we've developed in VA to try to find folks, ICD, or International mm-hmm. Classification of Disease Codes, that are often kind of termed as billing codes in healthcare, mm-hmm. Around gender identity disorder. So this is problematic on a lot of levels. One, because it clearly pathologizes someone's gender identity.
Yeah.
And that we're capturing a very, like a specific subset of people mm-hmm. in VA. And another aspect of this is that in the DSM, or the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, gender identity disorder was taken out of that, and now it's called gender dysphoria. Mm-hmm. But in the ICD catalog, which we use in VA for the data we pulled, gender dysphoria is not part of the ICD. So it's still GID, or gender identity disorder, in the ICD. So that's why
So it's considered a disorder.
As far as the ICD billing goes, but in the general world of sort of healthcare and providing services to people, it's gender dysphoria. But because we're relying on sort of medical record data in the ICD catalog, we're sort of bound by what the ICD still labels.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's just to explain why, you know, I would still say GID, or gender identity disorder.
Yeah.
It is not something that we would typically use anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So we had to rely on these codes to try to find the folks. And we did a validity study a couple years ago to look at, you know, it's a relatively rare code to be in the medical record, but we know mm-hmm. that, you know, it's not uncommon for errors in coding to come up and things like that. So mm-hmm. we looked at whether there might be evidence somewhere else in the record that would, you know, corroborate someone getting this, getting this diagnosis code.
Yeah.
And we did find about 90% of people who had this code also had some sort of mention from a provider that, you know, this patient identifies as transgender and wants to discuss, you know, hormone therapy. There are other things that were signifying that these mm-hmm. codes are helping us get to the population.
Yeah.
But it's still an imperfect way of doing it until we can really incorporate self-report gender identity, which is the gold standard, and would really change everything.
I can't imagine that happening in the current climate. You don't have to answer that.
I have concerns about how this will work when we transition to Cerner from what mm-hmm. we currently have in base. So the electronic health record switch has me nervous about it. There are definitely still major socio-cultural issues around having and introducing items like that. And I think that it's not impossible to do, and I think that there will be wrinkles along the way, but I think the cost of not doing it is greater, because this population has lived in invisibility. They've been invisible. And that we have to, health services researchers have to go to such, you know, sort of MacGyver type of ways to find them, to show that, you know, these major disparities exist for these folks with, you know, social stress factors like housing instability, with mental health issues, depression, anxiety, with health outcome issues like suicide attempt in this population is off the charts. So being able to find them, I think, is worth the growing pains of how we implement this in the medical record, because it's been ignored for too long.
Is the housing instability, is that mainly a result of job insecurity because of their transgender identity, or are there other?
I mean, I think we can't really know that from the data that we have at the VA, but I think from the literature, and there's not a ton about it, but there is discrimination in housing and jobs. And there's also a lot of experience of trauma. And we found with women veterans, cisgender women veterans, that just these experiences of trauma sort of prior to military, so, you know, adverse childhood experiences and physical assault, sexual assault during military, intimate partner violence potentially afterwards, that these like accumulates and it compounds, and it is a major pathway into housing instability for women particularly. And we know that transgender people, particularly when they're homeless, are much more likely to experience violent victimization. They also have much higher rates of comorbid conditions, much higher rates of HIV. Transgender or gender nonconforming individuals have much higher rates of unsheltered homelessness compared to like staying in an emergency shelter, which also could be, you know, we are kind of finding this and the studies that we're doing, because sometimes the shelters are not a welcome place.
Are they forthcoming about participating in research, or are they reluctant?
So the work we've done so far has just been with existing
data.
Yeah. The HUD-MASH study, people were very, like, we had recruited people from the roster of, like, kind of everyone who's in HUD-MASH, just kind of randomly drew people. And folks were very willing to participate. And it wasn't necessarily they were being, like, we were selecting them based on a certain characteristic, like, what is your experience of living in HUD-MASH? And, like, how has that been? And looking at what are sort of themes that are emerging among, you know, cisgender or non-transgender women, cisgender or non-transgender men, and then we had mostly people who were, they all identified as transgender women, because in the VA, the nature of our population is 90% of our patients are assigned male sex at birth. And so different themes did pop up, and some of them were about folks saying, I took the first house that, or the first housing I could get, even though it was in an unsafe neighborhood, because I had to get out of the shelter. Or that I didn't want to go to a shelter, and so they kind of helped me get housing faster because I just felt so uncomfortable there and so unsafe there. And that, you know, issues of discrimination among landlords and trying to find a place and navigating that. But they also brought really positive things that helped them get through some of the challenge, the unique challenges that they face. So one person had relayed how integral their case manager was when they had an issue with their documentation. So their documentation didn't necessarily match their gender presentation whenever they went to sign for a lease, and so the landlord had some skepticism about it. And so the case manager helped to diffuse that situation, like, like, this is what's going on. You know, so there were definitely opportunities where, I've never actually talked with a HUD-MASH case manager. I assume that they they have to roll with some pretty dynamic situations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great that there are instances where they can, you know, still get things done, even though it may be
mm-hmm.
a unique situation they haven't encountered before. But a lot of the transgender people we talked to who were in HUDBASH also mentioned the need for more visibility, more training, more sort of, you know, getting their voices and their stories heard so people will know how to, you know, deal with this more, because they are using HUDBASH at a very
mm-hmm.
high rate.
So do you want to talk about some of the findings?
We have found that, transgender veterans screen positive for housing instability at a much higher rate than non-transgender veterans. I think non-transgender veterans, about 2.8% of them over the observation period
mm-hmm.
screen positive for housing instability, and about maybe 8.5% of the transgender veterans did. And then when we controlled for other factors like where they lived, sex, age, race, service-connected disability,
mm-hmm.
We found that transgender veterans did have double the odds of self-reporting housing instability,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty significant.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when looking at veterans who, among the sample of veterans who screened positive for housing instability,
mm-hmm.
who was accessing VHA homeless
mm-hmm.
programs, transgender veterans much more frequently access these programs. They had lower odds of accessing programs like grant and per diem, which are sort of 6 month transitional housing, typically
mm-hmm.
in a congregate setting, probably shared bathrooms, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Lower odds of accessing those sorts of resources.
Yeah, 'cause that's going to be difficult.
Yeah, but definitely higher odds compared with non-transgender veterans of
mm-hmm.
accessing HUDVASH. And then they also, you know, access supportive services for veteran families, which is more about, you know, you may have housing and it helps you to keep it.
Future steps for your research and potential impacts.
I think one impact of it is, again, to circle back to the utilization part,
mm-hmm.
and not to paint it with too rosy of a lens, but I mean, we expected to see this disparity in the prevalence of housing instability,
mm-hmm.
And we hoped to see a similar disparity. Like, you know, if they're having a greater prevalence of housing instability, we're hoping they have a higher prevalence of using housing services, that VA is reaching these services, people are getting connected to the services they need, and it's not the opposite way around.
Mm-hmm.
So that we found they're, you know, both of them are high. It's better than finding they're high on housing instability and low on using services.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Right.
And being able to disaggregate those services to find out which potential services to investigate further. So among the suite of housing
mm-hmm.
programs that we can offer to, or supportive services we can offer to people experiencing housing instability, are there some
mm-hmm.
that we could do maybe a little bit more implementation research into in terms of, you know, provider training or sort
mm-hmm.
of like learning? I would really love to learn about the sort of occupational wisdom of
mm-hmm.
the case managers and the people
yeah.
who work in these highly variable situations
mm-hmm.
and sort of get like a life hack book from them.
Yeah.
Say, what
yeah.
worked for you? What sort of tips would you have to give to other people who
yeah.
want to help folks and might be in, you know, rural settings or
right.
in different areas of a city that, you know, they, you know, what are the, because these are the folks who are learning it each and every
right.
day. And we can learn more, definitely more, from engaging veterans and their sort of experiences navigating the system as well, and pairing those
right.
two things together to help improve those services and amplify them for this minority population. I think that would be a good sort of, you know, next step in terms of, we found this signal, and what does that mean in terms of the service utilization, and where
mm-hmm.
are the aspects of, you know, bolstering the positive and trying to break down the barriers in that.
Yeah.
And I think one challenge is, you know, like John mentioned, it's a minority population.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, out of a sample of 6 million veterans,
mm-hmm.
we identified 6,000
right.
Transgender veterans. And so, you know, there may need to be more resources around, you know, emergency shelter for transgender
mm-hmm.
veterans, because
mm-hmm.
they're uncomfortable going to these other, you know, congregate
right.
situations. But there may be three cities in the country where that's sustainable.
Right.
Because of such a small number of people. And so I think that, you know, I think what John said about learning from, you know, the people who are doing this work and then sort of disseminating that, because it's just sort of, I hate to use this cliche, but it's like one tool in the toolbox. Do you know what I mean? That everyone may need. You don't know when. Most case managers probably won't encounter this.
Right.
I think HubVash has like 5,000 case managers or something.
Right.
So a handful of them will, you know, for everyone to just at least be
aware
of it and aware of, you know, what can help in case you need that one day, in case that's the person you need to help one day.
But if you're helping the veterans who are transgender, and you've identified perhaps 6,000, there are thousands more who are homeless who are not veterans.
And I just want to make a plug. We have, so the LGBT health program is nested in patient care services right now, I think. Michael Koff in Houston and Jillian Shippard in Boston co-direct the LGBT health, and they have done an immense, amazing amount of work at a relatively short amount of time.
Wow.
And so internal to VA, they developed a SharePoint site that has, I mean, almost anything you could hope to find about clinical care for transgender patients. There's also an LGB SharePoint for folks. Because although we often use the LGBT acronym, it's sexual orientation and gender identity are separate constructs, but they are related, but they are distinct. And there are a lot of resources within the VA system there's a e-consultation network. It's mainly for, some of it built around clinical care.
Yeah.
But the SharePoint site has a lot of just general information in it as well that people, as long as they're internal to VA, can access.
Thank you both for taking the time.
Yeah.
Is there anything last words that you want to say about working at the VA or working with veterans?
I think the VA is an excellent place to do work and learn more about these sort of very minority populations. I mean, because you have to have a sample of 6 million veterans to be able to find a reasonable
6,000,
sample of transgender veterans, and you really and to do research on homelessness, because there's so many different indicators and so many different services, and it's all in this huge data system, and there's really nowhere else in the country or the world where you can learn this kind of information.
And I'll just add that even though they are small populations, as a health equity researcher, we know that their needs are often more complex. They're often more vulnerable to a lot of adverse and worse outcomes. And so the ability to better understand that, to essentially get services to the folks who are the most vulnerable in our system is, I mean, I feel like that's just part of our charge in VA.
The views and opinions expressed in the preceding podcast are concerned with the scope of recently concluded or ongoing VA HSR&D funded research and do not necessarily reflect current or to be implemented VA policy. To learn more about this research, visit the VA HSR&D website at www.hsrd.research.va.gov.